This is McGuire on the Wire, brought to you by McGuire Sponsel. We are a national consulting firm aiming to provide facts, advice, and updates on the ever-changing world of tax law. This podcast will give you base-level information as well as high-level thought leadership on how to navigate these technical disciplines. At McGuire Sponsel, we provide unique services to our clients using an old-school, hands-on approach that is deeply respected within the CPA industry. Now stick around and listen to one of our experts. We're glad you're here.
Thank you for joining us today. In the last couple of years, and really in the last few months, there's been a lot of changes to depreciation law, whether it be from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act or the TCJA, even going back further to the tangible property regs, or now with the CARES Act and some of the changes there. There have been a lot of changes with how depreciation is handled, how decisions are made, etc., that we want to spend some time discussing. With that in mind, I've asked Justin Gephardt, who heads up our cost seg practice, to sit in with me today to talk about some of these. Welcome, Justin.
Well, thanks for having me, Dave. And to kind of echo on your point, I would completely agree. You know, one of the frequent questions that we get is, you know, how does this piece of legislation affect cost segregation? Is it still relevant? And I think as we've seen over the past 6, 7, 8 years, each piece of legislation has actually made cost segregation more relevant and has created more opportunity for tax planning conversations.
So if we go back a little bit, I'm not going to really spend much time on the tangible property regs today, but if we talk about, let's say, the TCJA or the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, what were some of the big provisions that affected depreciation as it related to cost segregation in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act?
That's a good question. There are a few major points that the TCJA brought out, and we could start out with the bonus depreciation rates. You know, if you remember back to the PATH Act, bonus was slated to start dwindling with the phase out to be put in place by 2020. And what the TCJA put in place is it extended bonus depreciation for 10 years ultimately, with the first 5 years being a 100% bonus depreciation rate. And the second major piece is it expanded the definition for what was eligible for bonus appreciation. If you look prior to the tax reform, we were operating in the based off the first use test, which that said that essentially a property had to be newly constructed for a client to be able to be eligible for bonus appreciation. The removal of the first use test in tax reform opened up an opportunity for clients that were buying existing properties. And so while, you know, the clients or the real estate investors are going out and buying properties that were 10 years old, we now have the ability to do a cost segregation study, find the personal property in that facility, and take 100% bonus appreciation. The TCJA also expanded the definition of assets that were eligible for 179, and that was pretty influential when you talk about some of the QIP elements. And so prior to tax reform, as we look at it, you know, it was primarily to items that were non-structural in a facility. And the definition expanded it to include roof coverings, HVAC units. And so one of the major issues that we saw as a result of tax reform was when they first pushed this out was the confusion centered around qualified improvement property and what was the classification and how was bonus appreciation affecting that. While we waited for that to be fixed, clients and taxpayers did have the avenue to take advantage of the 179 expenses falling under QIP. So those are just a few of the major items that we've seen our clients kind of latch on to as a result of the TCJA.
So under the TCJA, the QIP, roofs, HVAC are all 179 eligible, correct?
That's correct.
So does that mean that they're all bonus eligible, or what's the difference between 179 and bonus in that situation?
Yeah, good point. So it does not necessarily mean that they're bonus eligible, because a lot of those items, roof coverings, HVAC units, those are still considered real property. And if you look under the definition of qualified improvement property, you know, the way that it's structured does not, at that time, did not include some of those assets to be bonus eligible.
So Now, if I'm taking, so I'm taking 179 on the roof, etc. What are the limitations to 179? Is there a reason that I would want bonus over 179, or are they work about the same way?
Well, I think you would want to take the, you know, when you look at, there are phase out limitations. And so it is important to, when you're approaching the $2.5 million phase out of your improvements, that we don't necessarily just want to try to expense everything, because there is opportunity, you know, especially as you look at getting close to that phase out. Are there areas that we can move assets into shorter life? From a bonus standpoint, are there assets that we can write off from and kind of help navigate and keep that client underneath that phase out limitation?
Now, with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and I know a lot of people are probably listening going, okay, get into the CARES Act, but I want to make sure we're covering a lot of this. With the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, there was a lot of talk about the 163J, or the interest limitation. Now, I know there was an ability to elect real property trade or business, but if I'm not mistaken, there's some restrictions as to what's bonus eligible if you take that real property trade or business election. Does it still make sense to do a cost seg, or can you talk about those restrictions a little bit?
Yeah, it's what I would tell you is it still makes sense. What we saw when the guidance first came out, really the biggest industry that we saw a lot of questions was in the residential side, the multifamily. And they didn't necessarily want to elect out and be limited by their interest expense. And there was this fear that if they did a cost seg, that they would lose out on their ability to expense the interest. And if you look very closely in how the wording's put together, is that it refers specifically to real property. And so what we were able to do and help guide our multifamily clients in other industries that had these questions, we were able to do the benefit of a cost seg, separate the real property from the personal property. Now, the real property had to follow ADS. And so when you look at the multifamily side, you know, you're going from a 27 and a half year to a 30 year. So not a substantial difference. On properties outside of the multifamily industry, you know, they did have to go from 39 to 40. So again, not a significant difference there. The key there, though, is again, we were able to separate and go after the personal property because it did not fall in that definition or the restrictions under that language. And so there was a benefit to doing both, essentially.
So the real property trader business, it only requires the ADS life on the real property. So that's the 27 and a half or 39 year, or I guess now the QIP, which as we'll explain in the CARES Act portion.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Now with that, so what, why do we have this? I know a lot of people have heard about QIP or qualified improvement property. And I know there's been a lot of articles, and I think we've actually even had a couple potentially of these podcasts talking about the retail glitch, but do you want to just remind people of what this was and why we had to address it?
Yeah. So QIP, if you look backwards, it was put in place in the PATH Act. And the initial definition for QIP, qualified improvement property, was that it was an improvement put into place after the facility or the building was initially placed in service. And it has to be an interior renovation, not related to structural components. So for a two-year period, that created some significant opportunities for clients. What happened when the TCJA was pushed through, the language was updated, and there were some key components that were missing when that final bill was passed. And what that included was the qualified improvement property was no longer bonus eligible. It had kind of been stricken from that bonus eligible language. It also remained as 39-year property. However, in the tax reform conversation, TCJA, their intent, if you look in the notes, the congressional notes, their intent was to make it a 15-year property with bonus eligible ability. And so for a couple years, we were waiting on this technical correction to take place, and it just never transpired. And then with the CARES Act, you know, it kind of caught a lot of us by surprise because we weren't necessarily expecting this. And so the CARES Act came out and they kind of fixed that glitch and they said, okay, now we can take qualified improvement property. We're moving it to a 15-year life and we're making it bonus eligible. And so in the short term, what that did, you know, and a lot of what the CARES Act was put in place to do was to help with cash flow. It was to try to bring as much cash to the client to taxpayers as possible in light of the challenging times that we were in. And so that ability to make qualified improvement property 15-year and to go back retroactively to back to January 1st, 2018 to capture that benefit really made a tremendous impact for our clients.
So with QIP coming in under the CARES Act, so obviously the CARES Act created QIP, or didn't create it, but changed the definition to make it 15-year property, make it bonus eligible, and with an ADS life of 20 years. With that coming in, does it still make sense? Let's say I bought a building and I renovated it and completely gutted the interior, probably painted the outside, replaced the roof, put new HVAC. I just wanted to buy an old building and make it nicer. Should I still be calling you to do a cost seg study, or should I go, hey, it's all QIP, I'm going to bonus it all out?
Yeah, it still makes sense to give us a call to take a look at it, because what that exercise is really about minimizing any potential audit exposure. Because if you go back to that definition and what I kind of indicated earlier, qualified improvement property is interior, but it cannot contain any structural components. And so that's where the benefit of you know, maybe calling us on an interior renovation, and we could take a look at that budget and kind of analyze, okay, here's some components that need to be pulled out. You know, from our experience in the last couple of weeks and months, you know, there are going to be times where, hey, you know what, it doesn't make sense to do a cost segregation study, and we're going to be the first ones to tell you. I actually just had a client up in Wisconsin about a week ago call, and we were kind of walking through this interior renovation. I asked him to shoot me over a construction budget, you know, and there was one line item that really applied to a structural component, and so I kind of called him back and said, hey, you know what, this really doesn't make sense to do a study. Just pull out this one line item and book it as real property, and the rest you should be able to book as qualified improvement property. However, there are going to be those other instances where there is substantial structural components that we do need to pull out and help separate.
So if I'm understanding you right, we should still look into a cost seg study, because just because I've renovated an existing building, I might still have to pull out the roof or the HVAC or exterior doors, windows, that kind of thing from all the stuff that's inside the building.
Yeah, absolutely correct.
Now, so we've got the CARES Act, obviously. As you mentioned, it was designed to increase cash flow for companies. Were there any other provisions in the CARES Act that affect decision-making with a cost segregation study?
Yeah, so it actually did a couple things and some additional guidance that followed. You know, one of the biggest pieces that we've seen is the effect on net operating losses. And if you look in the past, you know, it was really our conversations on the cost segregation field were really looking forward. You know, how does it affect cash flow this year and the following years? Well, you know, with the pandemic and with businesses being shut down, you know, a lot of the conversation again was around that cash flow. And it's also, you know, this year may not be as profitable. And so how do we help taxpayers gain more access to cash? And that this key on the NOL is being, we're now allowed to go backwards. And so we can potentially go back 5 years to capture a benefit and a cost seg and carry those accelerated depreciations backwards to create an NOL. And so what that has done is, you know, assuming there's no passive loss issues there, going back into prior tax years, creating that NOL, which it essentially is a tax refund into the client's pocket. And so that was kind of the big piece with CARES Act and some additional strategies. You know, the other, you know, as we talk about the 30% interest limitation, you know, one thing that the CARES Act did and the subsequent guidance that was issued is it allowed certain elections for us to go back and retract those elections. And that was one of them. You know, a lot of clients, they elected into that 30% interest limitation election. And, you know, with QIP, it wasn't a big deal at the time. But now, since it got bumped into that 15-year class life, the amount that they were potentially losing was going to be more substantial. And so those were the two big items, again, the NOLs and the ability to go back and to adjust certain elections that help clients moving forward.
So what you're saying is if I am looking at, let's say I'm looking at 2019 right now, and I haven't filed my 2019 return because it got extended to July 15th, and I've got $200,000 worth of taxable income, and you do a cost seg study and find $1 million in potential deductions, that would obviously push me into a loss. So you're saying that I can carry that back into past years and use that loss? I don't have to just suspend it and pull it forward?
Yeah. And so, again, let's take that example and the taxpayer. Let's say that you cut a check to the government in 2018 for, you know, $400,000. You would take that NOL back and apply it against that $400,000 and ultimately receive that back as a refund. And you can keep going back until that's used up. And so, again, it can be a good measure for taxpayers moving forward.
And then you also mentioned the 163J, and obviously the decision-making process that we made. I think you and I had a lot of conversations with people before the CARES Act, just saying be careful making that election because it's an irrevocable election. And then I know the CARES Act actually changed that 30% to 50%. And now you're saying that I can actually go back and amend a return and get out of that deduction over in a short period of time?
Yeah. That was one ability to go back and change. The other one that we see a lot is clients, you know, maybe it didn't make sense for bonus depreciation in prior years, and they would elect out of bonus depreciation. And that's another capability moving forward, or another ability moving forward to go back and change.
So if I want to really maximize those NOL carrybacks you were talking about, let's say if I filed my 2018 and 2019 return, I elected out a bonus depreciation, or I elected this 163J, I elected real property, trade, or business, I could go back and get out of those two elections, create big losses, and carry them back?
Absolutely. And if you look ahead, you know, again, towards the end of this year, as we start focusing on 2020 tax planning and we start advising clients, and these are all going to be areas that are going to be pretty relevant to explain to taxpayers and to everyone's clients of, hey, here are some other strategies that we necessarily didn't have in the past that we now can take advantage of to help create as much cash flow savings, tax savings as we possibly can.
Now, kind of onto the implementation of a lot of this. I know we, on this podcast a couple weeks ago, we were talking about R&D tax credits and how we could have really three open years that we can look at and we can amend returns. Is it similar on a cost seg study? If I've say I built a building in 2012 and now I need some deductions out of it, is it kind of too late for me? I missed that window, or is there some way I can still get some of those deductions?
Yeah, there's obviously the potential there, and that's honestly kind of the cool part about cost segregation is that we can go pretty far back. We can go back to 1987 if we wanted to, but you know, from a net present value, that doesn't make sense. What I would tell you is that we really want to look at buildings that were placed in service after the year 2000. And in that time frame, we can go back, file a 3115. There's a Section 41A adjustment that we calculate for the client. And that helps catch up all the depreciation that was quote-unquote missed. I do think it is important to notate some of those elections and the NOL carrybacks that those only apply for tax returns that are filed for 18, 19, and 20. And so after 2020, that ability for the time being kind of goes away, assuming nothing gets pushed out into the future. So while we have the ability to go back and capture depreciation, there are certain strategies that do kind of sunset.
So just obviously, so that means that if I'm looking at a building that was 10 years old, if I missed out on $1 million of depreciation, you're saying I can just go file at 3115, which I believe is change in accounting method, and recapture all that depreciation?
Yeah, and it's a pretty easy process. It's painless. It gets filed on your current year tax return, so there is no amending of returns. Again, you file that 3115 with your return the year that it's open.
Now, it sounds like there have been a lot of changes in recent years. Obviously, it sounds like it's a little bit hard to keep up on. Do you have any advice for people that think, well, we can just handle this ourselves or anything else? Or do you have any kind of closing remarks on that?
Yeah, and that's a very good point. You know, for so long, depreciation stayed pretty stagnant. You know, bonus depreciation came in and out. maybe some classifications, you know, the 15-year QLI and QRP were put into place. But really in the last 7-8 years, there were so many regulations that were issued, and they've all become very beneficial. And I, you know, that's a very good question in terms of, we get that a lot from our clients. You know, why don't we just do some of this in-house? And what we've been able to see, and we review, you know, thousands of depreciation schedules in a given year, and there's just so much out there that it's kind of hard to stay up to date on. And that's where our team is a very valuable resource. We've got a very deep bench. You know, we have over 20 plus people on our cost seg team, and we have clients of all shapes and sizes from all industries. So we have a pretty deep base of experience, no matter the building type, no matter the tax situation. And so that's where our team, you know, that's where I would kind of advise to lean on our team for guidance and for resource, even if it's just a call to kind of bounce off an idea or to make sure that, you know, you're understanding the legislation as it's written. That's what we're here for. And it's one thing we've always preached is that, you know, we always want to be an extension of your firm. You know, we want to be treated as if we're right there in your office. And that's the one thing I would just preach over and over and over. If you have questions, if there are some type of situation that your client may be in, please don't hesitate to call. We were actually just dealing with a client this week to where, you know, the CPA firm picked up a new client, and there were a lot of, you know, assets that they were trying to get their hands around, it, and they kind of just called us up and said, hey, can you help us kind of create a narrative around why some of these assets are that we think are incorrect, and really help us out here? And so we created a narrative, got on the phone with the CPA, and kind of walked through. Well, that CPA was kind of able to look like a hero to their client because they were able to point out, hey, this is why you're using our firm, because we have the experts in place to come and get the right answer and to help minimize exposure while capturing as much benefit as possible. And I know it's kind of a long-winded answer there for you, Dave, but that's kind of what I would say is, we're here to be a extension of your firm and to be able to be a resource for you guys to count on.
Well, thank you. I mean, it does seem like it's a little bit of a confusing time. There's been a lot of regulations. Cash is tight for a lot of businesses. Businesses are looking at what some uncertainty in the future. And it sounds like some of these new changes, whether it be the NOL carrybacks, whether it be filing a 3115, are great opportunities for people to really access some of these systems that have been in place for years and really have access to either whether it be maximizing depreciation deductions, pulling through cash flow from old returns or other things. This is really something that's very timely, and I appreciate the time that you've spent today. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, I appreciate everyone listening today. If you have any questions about this or any other area that we've discussed on one of these podcasts or anywhere else, feel free to reach out to us. We look forward to working with you all in the future.
Thanks so much for listening to McGuire on the Wire. Have a question from today's episode or interested in our team covering another topic? Reach out to us at McGuire on the Wire at McGuireSponsel.com.